A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost, here every weekday from 9 until 1 with my producer Annie Weston on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. This is the time of the week where we welcome the team from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online, into the studios. Editor Simon Lambert here today with journalist Mark Shoffman. And what's next for the pound? We'll be talking about up against the euro, sinking against the dollar. Is it wise to snap up some holiday cash now? Are we in the midst of a currency price war? Buy-to-let traps, how to avoid those classic mistakes. Should renters face an immigration test? What's the latest on TSB? And at what age should you start worrying about funding for your retirement? Plus, we're asking today, as we've been talking about prenups, new research showing they're not just for the celebs or the super rich. Oh no, a third of under 35-year-olds would happily sign one before getting married. So we're asking today, quite simply, to prenup or not to prenup? That is the question I'm about to ask editor Simon Lambert. Prenup or no prenup?
Morning, Georgie. I don't know. It's a difficult question, isn't it? I think people think about this as like in terms of people who are really wealthy. But I think where this is coming from is to do with people buying properties. And it's basically to do with people getting deposits from their parents or some help from their parents in order to buy a property. And what you often find is potentially the two parties might be very unequal. So, for example, you know, a parent might give, you know, the daughter might get £30,000 off her parents, but the son's, the other partner's parents might not have that kind of money. So you end up with a scenario where people are putting much more money down on a property. And so I think sometimes, you know, parents are actually very conscious of this, of like, if their child splits up and the worst happens, do they need to try and put something in place so that it means that, you know, down the line, there's less of a problem? Because I know certainly from my own personal experience that I had a friend who was in a similar situation, and it ended up in a lot of arguments and recrimination down the line. And actually, when we bought our first flat, we had unequal deposits, me and my wife, but back then she was my girlfriend at the time. And we didn't sign any prenup or anything like that, but you can sign, you know, a legal agreement and hold the property as tenants in common, that says that, you know, if anything were to happen, the one person takes the first X amount, the other person takes the next X amount, and then you split everything evenly. So I personally probably wouldn't do one if I was getting married, but I can see why people do it.
I hate to break this to you, Simon. You are already married. You got married.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Of course. Yeah, that bit. Yeah. I didn't do it when I got married.
Listening.
There you go. I didn't do it when I got married.
Yeah, he's not planning on remarrying. I'd like to point that out. Mark Shoffman, your views on this subject?
I think it's a pretty bad way to start your marriage off by having this kind of prenup over your head and kind of these terms and conditions. But the I do think the tenants in common arrangement and that kind of legal side, that I think that makes more sense. But a prenup just has a whole load of connotations to it, which I think are a bad way to start your life together.
They're still not legally enforceable, are they, either, prenups in this country? I might be wrong, you know, but my understanding was that.
Any solicitors listening, do get in contact. Annie, how can solicitors or listeners get in contact? To prenup or not to? That is the question.
You can tweet us at Share Radio UK. You can email us at consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk. You can drop us a text as well at 66777. And if you start your text with the word share, and I just had a text in actually, no to a prenup. If you don't trust your partner or even yourself to stay in the marriage, then why get married?
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money. Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost. Now it's the time of the week where the team from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online, are here live in the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert, reporter Mark Shoffman, and it's been a big week for the British pound as it's reached a 7-year high against the euro, but at the same time also sinking against the dollar, currently at a 12-month low. So should you buy your holiday cash now, take advantage of the best exchange rates in more than 7 years, with interest rates falling around the world. Also, we're seeing a bit of a currency war going on. Simon, break all this down. Firstly, the pound against the euro. What does it all mean?
Well, I've got a chart on the screen in front of me here, actually, that I just called up, that basically goes back a year. And a year ago, we were actually celebrating because, or thinking that we were doing all right, because we were at €1.20 to the pound. And this week, it's finally gone back above €1.40. So that's a considerable saving if you're going on holiday, for example. And the reason why this is happening is because, basically, the Eurozone has cut interest rates at the same time whilst we've kept ours level. And they've brought in quantitative easing at the same time as we've pretty much made it clear that we're probably not going to do any more. And so what, you know, the global investing sort of world is looking at is that the euro now looks like a worse bet than the pound does. So they are, if they were given the choice, they're buying pounds, they're selling euros. That pushes up the pound, pushes down the euro.
And yet the dollar, we throw that into it.
Well, yeah. So this question of should you be buying your holiday money now? Well, it depends where you're going, really. So the opposite has actually occurred against the dollar. So if you look at the dollar, actually the pound had strengthened quite a lot against the dollar this time last year, because at the start of 2014, there was this sort of thought that went round that we might put up interest rates much sooner than was planned. There was a lot of talk around the property market overheating and something had to be done about that, that the recovery was, you know, getting a grip, and that the talk was that interest rates would have risen maybe last November time, November 2014. Well, we're now at the start of 2015 and we're talking about whether they'll even rise this year. And in fact, the consensus is that they won't. Whereas in the US, the suggestion is that interest rates will probably rise about summertime. So people, if you were given the choice between the two, they're buying the dollar, they're selling the pound, that pushes the dollar up, that pushes the pound down. So we're caught in this kind of very strange scenario where our currency is doing very, very well against one of the major currencies we compare it against and not doing so well against the other.
Are we seeing, because we're limiting this to the Eurozone, the US and the UK, but are we seeing a bit of a currency war globally? And can we even call it currency war, perhaps a race to the bottom almost as well?
Maybe. Currency war is a term that people really don't like in sort of global economics, because it is ultimately something of a race to the bottom. And this idea of, well, one devalues their currency in order to make themselves more competitive in terms of selling their goods to the rest of the world, and then someone else has to do the same thing, and then someone else has to do the same thing. You just end up in this sort of tit-for-tat scenario. I mean, whether you could argue that we are seeing something along those lines at the moment, because one of the unspoken objectives, you know, that is going on with the Eurozone, with quantitative easing, with the negative interest rates over there, is to get the euro down and to make European countries more competitive for selling their goods to the rest of the world. One of the aims in Japan is to get the Japanese currency, the yen, down, so that it's cheaper for people to buy Japanese stuff. And that's working. You know, those Japanese companies are managing to sell more stuff to the rest of the world, because if you're selling someone, for example, a Japanese car or something, it can make quite a big difference on the price. And a dealership in the States or a dealership over here can basically offer a consumer a better deal, you know, thanks to that currency element. I mean, the problem with currencies is it's always a bit swings and roundabouts. And what you'll see is, you know, we've just watched the pound go up against the euro, but maybe it fell too far against the euro in the past and the euro should have been weaker, and it all tends to work itself out in the end, to be perfectly honest.
You're the big investor. Is currency the place to invest?
Oh, currency trading is notoriously difficult. Basically, it's a world of charts and lines and Bollinger Bands and all kinds of what they call technical analysis, which involves, you know, trying to work out which way a currency is going to go. Then you bring into it macroeconomic factors, you know, what will this country do? What will that country do? And basically, I mean, in my experience, you know, when people are trying to do this, what they're normally trying to do is just make very small amounts places and like incrementally build that up. Whereas as a private investor, if you go, right, I'm going to bet against the dollar, or I'm going to, you know, I'm going to go with the dollar and bet against the euro, you can guarantee the exact opposite is going to happen and you're going to get hit.
Well, Mark Shoffman, let's focus on the, should we be buying up our holiday cash now?
Well, this is the thing. If I look at my experience, I've been booking some holidays around Europe for the summer, and I've paid about £220 to stay in Corsica for a week in some apartments. And whereas I stayed in Butlins in Bognor Regis a couple of weeks ago for about £250 just for a weekend. And one of those looks out over the Mediterranean and one looks out over the Channel, is it, or the North Sea? So where would you rather be? So you are getting more for your money. But the thing is with this whole buying more holiday money, you're not going to necessarily buy loads of cash travel around with loads of cash with you. You're more likely to want to put it on a currency card or on a kind of credit card or debit card. So what you also need to be doing is looking at the best cards to be doing that on, because otherwise you'll still get hit with exchange rates and those sorts of charges.
So the key is I've also got stashed away from my trip to Dusseldorf quite a few euros left over. Worth keeping hold of them as euros then?
I think that the issue with this whole buy your currency now scenario is that basically if you buy your currency now, you might find that the pound continues to appreciate against the euro. So let's talk about people who are going to Europe. You might find the pound continues to appreciate against the euro, and by the time you go on holiday in a month's time or 2 months' time, it's actually €1.50. You might find the opposite, and it goes back down to €1.30. What you need to look at is basically, if you're thinking of this whole buy your currency now, is that it gives you an opportunity to set the price that you're paying, so that you know that that hotel that you're booking or that villa that you're booking is going to cost you X amount, and it's not going to move. And then you have to weigh up which way you think it's going to go. And it's the same with the euros that you've got stashed in your drawer somewhere, I presume. Is, you know, are those euros just going to be useful for you the next time you go to Europe, which you're probably going to do, so you can keep them there and use them next time? Or would you rather have the money back now and have the money now to spend? I mean, ultimately, if you're keeping euros in your drawer, you're not earning any interest on them. But then I'm guessing that you don't have thousands and thousands of euros stashed in the drawer, so it's not that much of an issue.
And stashed in the drawer, you know me so well. So when you're buying currency, pace the shop around, Mark, doesn't it? Don't certainly go to the airport.
Yes, don't go to the airport. Don't necessarily trust your bank. Look at people like M&S, the post office.
It's currency specialists like Moneycorp and Travelex and people like that. Buy it in advance. And actually, I'll tell you where this really pays off is not necessarily that like everyday spending money that you've got on holiday. It's when you're paying for something that is substantial. So say, for example, you were paying for hiring a villa for 2 weeks, or even you were actually buying a property abroad. That's where fixing a currency at a certain rate and knowing exactly how much you're going to be paying is something that really pays off. And that's where using a currency specialist to transfer the money can save you an awful lot. So the last couple of years, when we've been on holiday, we rented apartments. We went down to Italy a couple of years in a row and rented an apartment. And the cost of transferring the money to do that through my bank versus the cost of I used a service with Moneycorp, the cost of doing that with them, there was a big difference in it. So, you know, it's like £50. It saved us, you know, what was not an unreasonable sum. And that's maybe £50 on an £800 bill. So your bank does tend to hit you with a sort of a worse exchange rate and some fees down the line. So it can pay off.
Before we start talking about banks, one in particular, TSB, I do have to ask, you mentioned earlier something about prepaid currency cards.
These are something that have become a lot more popular in recent years, in terms of you can load the money up onto them and then you've got the money on there. But there is, you know, there's another alternative to this, which is that you go out and try and find yourself one of the banks where you've got a bank account or a credit card where it's much less expensive to spend overseas on it. And then you can just treat that as you would do your normal bank or current account card. So, for example, it used to be that Nationwide offered you didn't pay any fees for spending overseas. Unfortunately, they got rid of that some years ago. But on a Nationwide current account, it's still slightly cheaper than it is with other current accounts. And there was the Halifax Clarity card where there was no charges for spending overseas as well. And it's worth having a look for these things. And actually, if you go to This Is Money, we've got our holidays section. And in there, we've got a roundup of the best ways to spend abroad, which includes currency cards, bank accounts, credit cards, and so on.
On your website at the moment, so the current prepaid currency cards, like a modern-day version, I guess, as you said, of traveller's checks. Goodness me, do they still exist, traveller's checks? A safe way to take money abroad, offering better value, scout around for the one without purchase or withdrawal fees. If you do lose your card, most providers will replace it with the balance intact for a small fee, though, and your money is also protected if your provider goes bust, and works in a very similar way to a gift voucher. But for more information, like you said, do go online to This Is Money.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
Very warm welcome. If you've just joined us in the studio with me, is Simon Lambert from This Is Money, editor and journalist Mark Shoffman here for our weekly catch-up. Now we've been speaking about the euro, let's turn our attentions to the banks. TSB, still remembered for its 1980s slogan, the bank that likes to say yes. But now the bank, which reappeared on our high streets 2 years ago, is in new takeover talks with the Spanish bank Sabadell. So will it say yes to Sabadell? Meanwhile, challenge bank Aldermore recently floated on the stock market and rival Shawbrook wants to follow suit. So what is the attraction of these new banks, and is Britain's banking landscape being shaken up? Let's focus on TSB then. What is the news coming out? Before we ask about Sabadell, just it's been a bit of an interesting time for TSB, hasn't it? Just give us a bit of a recap on their recent history.
It's been a bit busy, really. Mm. So Lloyds was forced to get rid of 631 branches as part of a EU thing to do with its bailout. And when it gets rid of those 631 branches, it doesn't just get rid of the buildings, it has to get rid of the customers that are associated with those branches. So what happened was Lloyds basically tried to sell this part of the bank, and it didn't really work. And then what they did was they relaunched TSB. They split it back out from Lloyds. Which it had been put together with in 1995, and TSB was launched to much fanfare less than 2 years ago, talking about how it was going to be bringing back local banking. That was its big thing, bringing back local banking. It then floated on the stock market last summer, and there was quite a few small shareholders who invested and so on.
What do we mean when we say something floated on the stock market? What's the relevance of that?
It listed on the stock market. So basically, TSB went from being owned as part of Lloyds to being listed on the stock market, and now you could buy shares in it. And the shares were popular. But they've struggled a bit since then. And then the news came out yesterday that the Spanish bank Sabadell has made a bid for TSB, and the shares shot up 25%. And Sabadell wants to buy TSB for £1.7 billion, and TSB has said that it thinks that's a good idea.
Well, I imagine it certainly does. What do we know about Sabadell?
Well, they probably don't count as local banking for the UK. We know that much. So it would be an interesting twist on bringing back local banking. Bringing back local banking, but owned by the Spanish. It was founded in 1881 with the aim of financing local industry. Since 2007, it has doubled in size and it has become Spain's fifth largest bank. It has 2,320 branches, 53 of them outside Spain, and 6.4 million customers. It also already acquired the Lloyds TSB network in Spain and Miami. You may think it sounds like I'm reading that.
I was about to
and
say.
And that's because I have not memorised all of that information about Sabadell. Until
Simon.
Yesterday, I didn't know who Sabadell were, if I'm going to be entirely honest. I do now.
How are they going to fund this move, do you know? It seems an extraordinary figure, £1.7 billion. So how have they valued it, this figure?
Well, so Lloyds has already raised £634 million from floating half of TSB, which is what it did. It listed half of TSB on the stock market, so it still retained a 50% stake. So what it wants to do is it wants to get rid of that other 50%. I mean, what's interesting about this is that the Spanish bank is looking at this UK bank and saying, well, we think that is a good investment and we think that's going to do well. And the thing about TSB is when TSB relaunched, basically, they made a big thing about how it was going to be a lot safer than other banks, and it was essentially going to be quite pedestrian. It was going to focus on that sort of good old stuff of savings and loans and things like that, and it was going to keep lots of capital. But actually, the way to make money out of a bank is to be a bit more racy, not necessarily to get into the investment banking, but to hold less capital and things like that and to be a bit less safe. And so there was always this question as to how TSB could achieve the sort of growth that people hoped for it. So maybe what's happening is Sabadell are looking at this and saying, well, TSB's got this good brand name, it's got this good opportunity, and we think that we could make more of it than is going to be made of it now.
Is this the end of independent local banks, independent banks?
Well, we've seen a lot of challenger banks come up. I mean, Mark, you look at, you know, mortgages and savings and things, and we're seeing quite a lot of, you know, new names there, aren't we?
Yeah, like when you look at the Best Buys now, it's not so much a big names like HSBC or Lloyds. You're seeing people like Aldermore coming up there. Or,
but are they not more specialised in terms of the more traditional larger banks?
Possibly.
Yeah, but I mean, I would say that arguably that's a good thing. You know, we've had this scenario where, you know, after the financial crisis, we looked at it and went, well, we've got too many big banks, and what we need is competition within the sector. And there is a lot more. There is competition now from what are called these challenger banks. But maybe a lot of those challenger banks aren't necessarily doing the kind of stuff that, you know, we think of as a bank doing. So for example, they might focus on developer finance, or they might focus on, you know, particular parts of sort of small business lending and stuff like that. But then arguably, that's where we need to channel the money in the economy at the moment, is to small and medium-sized businesses. Maybe it's the smaller developers, you know, rather than the big house builders and stuff like that. And unfortunately, the way that our big banks are set up, I just don't think they're properly set up to deal with that kind of thing anymore, because it's all centralised. So when TSB relaunched and made this big thing about bringing back local banking, I went to the launch and I asked the chief executive, I said, so where are these lending decisions for small businesses being made? And he said, well, they're being made centrally. So I said, well, not in the branch. I said, but if the branch knows that a small business would work, you know, this business would work in this area, and they have the local knowledge that someone who's in a call centre in Scotland doesn't have, will they be able to challenge it or overrule it? And he said, no. So, I mean, how local is that banking?
Very interesting. Mark, you did mention there, as I mentioned in the intro there, about challenger banks such as Aldermore and Shawbrook. Tell us about that.
So Aldermore and Shawbrook are two banks that have emerged in the last few years. I think, as we sort of mentioned earlier, they do kind of specialise more in niche areas like business finance, small businesses, and they're more about looking at doing their own kind of credit ratings and not kind of looking at central systems. And they have done quite well and are both looking to list on the stock market. And yeah, the advantage with these kind of smaller banks is they don't have the kind of big legacy systems that the older banks are having, and they won't have like possible payment protection insurance problems. So customers are benefiting from that, because they can concentrate more on products rather than having to pay compensation.
But they are protected in the same way.
Yes.
Good news for consumers and, I suppose, competition. But what we need to know is TSB talking about this deal, are they going to be affected by any moves, any takeovers?
Customers will, I mean, they'll just continue on as usual for the time being. But ultimately, down the line, they're going to be owned by a different set of owners who might have different ideas about the kind of products and things that they should be doing. And TSB's actually done some good products that have been quite popular. It's taken a good chunk of current accounts over the past year. And its current account is one of the current accounts that pays interest. So it pays up to 5% interest on balances up to £2,000. And I think that they also had this 10-year fixed rate mortgage that you could leave it after 5 years. So that's quite a good idea. But a lot of its products at the moment still look very similar to the Lloyds products. And there was this question of when are those paths going to properly diverge? Sooner than we think, possibly.
Andrew Lowe, who's an analyst at Berenberg, has said that the bid was a major surprise to us, Sabadell's bid there, and they estimate that the market is pricing it at an 80% chance of deal completion. They say that the Bank of England will likely impose strict conditions on any deal, and as a result, there remains a chance that Sabadell may yet walk away.
Maybe. And I mean, it's interesting that Sabadell's made this approach and TSB has said, yeah, we quite like this idea. And then obviously you get into the whole competition issues and the Bank of England and everyone looking at it. But what I think is interesting about this is that, is this a good thing? So if TSB floated 50% of it on the stock market and the plan was basically to offload the other 50% from Lloyds, so Lloyds basically no longer owned any of TSB, you would have had TSB as a separate entity, as a new bank there, and essentially as this sort of smaller challenger. It'd still be pretty big by banking terms. If that's then owned by another large Spanish bank, are we just taking that smaller challenger bank that we've created and putting it back in the hands of a big bank, or putting the two together to create another big bank? I don't know. I mean, do we want the banks to stay small and nimble? Do we want them to be just forming other big banks? Questions to be answered.
Want them to look after our money, I think. Do the simple things well.
They'll pay us more interest.
Well, if we're starting that debate, Simon, what do we want our banks to do? Do
not, get in not, context? Not crash the global economy.
That voice you're hearing, editor Simon Lambert from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of The Mail Online, joined in the studio with journalist Mark Shoffman. Coming up, buy-to-lets proving highly popular once again, but falling foul of a few classic mistakes could see you losing out.
Hello, I'm Ed Mitchell, and I present Investment Perspectives every weekday between 1 and 5pm. We take a deeper look at the major economic themes and developments that influence your investment choices. Investment Perspectives, guiding you through the money labyrinth.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
Warm welcome if you've just joined us. This is Consuming Issues. I'm Georgie Frost in the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert, journalist Mark Shoffman. Let's turn our attention away from the banks and TSB and onto property and buy-to-let, proving highly popular once again, but falling foul of a few classic mistakes could see you losing out. Now, Mark, you've been dishing out some good advice on the website This Is Money on avoiding some of those pitfalls this week. But firstly, just explain to us, well, a bit more about buy-to-let. What is it and why is it a good time to get involved?
Well, buy-to-let is the process where a property investor or landlord buys a property and then rents it out to tenants. And you can either do this by getting a buy-to-let mortgage, or if you have enough funds, you could buy a property yourself. So for buy-to-let landlords, the kind of property sector has been pretty good. In the last year, they saw returns of 11.7%. Which is pretty high.
It's not bad, not bad at all. We're seeing a resurgence in it. Good time because?
Well, it's a good time because house prices are rising, and it's also the flip side of a lot of first-time buyers struggling to get onto a property ladder and instead renting. So with more people renting, there's more opportunities for buy-to-let landlords to let out their properties.
Are we likely to see more with pension freedoms coming in as well?
That's what a lot of people are expecting. They're kind of anticipating pensioners will access their retirement savings and buy up properties and live off the rental income rather than annuities. Obviously, there are tax issues and implications to doing that.
Of course, there always are. But what do people need to think about before they start dipping their toe in this industry, this area?
Well, we have a brand new buy-to-let section on the This Is Money website where we've got some tips we're featuring at the moment. So the ultimate aim for many buy-to-let investors should be the rental yield, to make sure you're getting money coming in each month to cover your mortgage. But then you have to think about the location. It may be tempting just to buy a property and rent it out somewhere nearby where you live, but that may not be the best place to get your rental returns. So you could look out a bit further and may perhaps use a lettings agency to manage it for you. Capital growth is also important. You want to be able to make a profit if it comes to selling the house. And also management. You need to make sure you're looking after your tenants, keeping the property well maintained, and being a nice landlord and owner, because ultimately that's the way to get the best tenant and ensure your property is looked after and you're getting paid at the end of the day.
You can lose a lot of money in this if it goes wrong. What are the biggest pitfalls that you're seeing?
The biggest pitfalls are not getting the right tenants, the property not being looked after, finding the wrong location, not managing your costs as well, because at the end of each year you're going to have to do a tax return, and you, it's likely you're going to have some income tax on the rent. And so you're going to need money set aside in order to pay that, and you need to think about kind of expenses you can draw against that, and then you need to be able to pay for maintenance. So it's not a job necessarily just for a hobbyist. It can be quite expensive and time consuming.
So how do you get the best tenants then if that's one of the big problems?
Well, lettings agencies are quite good at finding people for you, or an estate agent, talking to people on, I don't know, social media, people you may know.
Well, I mean, one of the great advantages of the internet is it's now easier than ever to be a DIY landlord. So, you know, you can cut out the agent and you can save some money. And if you think that you are willing to do that and you're willing to put the work in, then that can be a very good idea, because it means that there's not, you know, 10% a month going to an agent. But you've got to know that if the boiler breaks down or if something goes wrong or the guttering's blocked, you've got to get around there and fix it. You can't just leave it. You can't just leave it until you can get around there in 2 weeks' time. You have a responsibility to your tenant. And the best way to get the best returns as a buy-to-let landlord is to look after your tenants, because what you want is tenants who will stay in your property and they don't want to leave. And if they do leave, for whatever reason, they might tell someone else about it and they might rent it, because you want to avoid void periods, which is like months when it's not let. And if you get a lot of churn of tenants, that's what happens. And, you know, you can advertise your property now online with a number of different sites for DIY landlords. Easy Property, mm-hmm. for example. There's one called House Simple. I think they do lettings as well. There's Sarah Beeney's one, Tepelo, I think they do lettings. And some of these sites will then get you onto Rightmove or Zoopla, which is really important because those are the big property portals and that's where a lot of people look. But it's also worth bearing in mind that the old-fashioned ways of sticking a note up on a notice board or getting word around the local school or things like that, or word of mouth.
Social really media, helped. Like you
social
said,
media, yeah.
See it all the
stick
time.
Stick it on Facebook kind of thing and get people to share it.
And that's a good way because generally you'll know people who know people who know people on Facebook.
But do it properly. Make sure it's got proper tenancy agreement. You take the deposit, you put it where it's meant to be, you look after the property and that you do your sums right, and it can work out. And buy-to-let's pretty divisive in this country because there's a lot of people who've made a lot of money from it. And there's a lot of people who see it as driving up prices for first-time buyers. And that one of the reasons people can't afford to buy is because there's all these landlords with all the money profiting from it.
Genuine concern, though?
It's one of those examples where profit goes to the people with capital. I don't think Thomas Piketty would be particularly happy about it. But that is just how life works. But the way to do it, if you're going to do it, is do it right. Look after your property, look after your tenants. And then what you're doing is you are providing a valuable utility in terms of a well looked after property for someone to rent. And if you're not willing to put the work into it, be very careful about going into it, and don't go in there with these sort of half baked ideas of I'm going to make £10,000-£20,000 really easily on property prices going up, because that's where people lose out. And we saw this before the financial crisis with people buying new build flats to buy to let, and there was all these new build blocks that were built. And you found that maybe 80%, 90% of the flats in there were all sold to landlords who then all tried to rent them at the same time. So that massively drove down the rents they could get because there was a huge amount of supply and not enough demand. And it pushed down the prices if they wanted to sell them, because all of a sudden there were lots of people who wanted to sell these flats at profit. And these theoretical gains that people thought they were going to see never materialised. And there's a lot of people who are still tens of thousands of pounds down on that, you know, 5-6 years later.
So lots of pitfalls. You did mention the good thing there is to be the best landlord you can be. Mark, you've given 5 tips, I think, on how to be a better landlord.
Well, you need to make sure the property is fit to rent from day one. So that will ultimately reduce your maintenance and repairs and keep your tenants happy. Number 2, you need to make sure you agree, if you're using a lettings agent, that any maintenance requests concerning safety or heating or water or lighting up to a certain value will immediately be carried out and reported to you. You should also consider moving your mortgages. So we've seen mortgage rates for residential properties hit record lows, but buy-to-let rates have also fallen to pretty decent levels as well. I think you can get a 2-year fix for about 2.29% now, but you'll need a big deposit for that. Bear that in mind. You need to establish a system, if you're using a lettings agent, where you get a copy of any inspection reports on a quarterly or half-yearly basis, so you know what's going on. And also, if it does just seem too difficult, consider selling up. Then you can benefit from a capital gain and then put your money elsewhere.
Well, very good tips there from journalist Mark Shoffman on buy-to-let. Your thoughts, editor Simon Lambert?
Well, I would just say one extra thing on this, which is for people who are considering buy-to-let and considering becoming a DIY landlord, which I think is a great way to do it yourself and to save some money. But my mum runs her own lettings agency. She's like her own independent lettings agency. She's worked in property for, you know, her entire working life. And I've seen firsthand how it works. You know, I've been involved in like working with her over the years. Do not underestimate the amount of work that goes into this. do not underestimate the amount of work that goes into having a plumber, an electrician, a person to come round and fix the guttering and getting all this stuff done. Because even as a lettings agent, with those people who you are giving regular work to throughout the year, the difficulty of getting someone around to fix a boiler in an emergency is still quite high. So if you're going to do this, you know, try and do it properly and be aware that you will have to put the work in.
On the theme of property there and talking of landlords, something on your website showing that soon they'll have to check the immigration status of their tenants or face fines of up to £3,000. The government says the right to rent scheme, which will be phased in later this year across the UK, will help in the fight against illegal immigration. Landlords will have to check whether would-be tenants are entitled to live in the UK before they hand over the keys to a residential property. Critics, though, believe many landlords could act unlawfully by breaching the Equality Act. First, what is this all about? Why is the government bringing this in now?
It's part of this desire to try and crack down on illegal immigration and people coming into the country and then just living here. So what they want to do is try and get them at that point where one of those things is made quite hard, i.e. where are you going to live? Your landlord or their agent is going to have to check up that you have the right to live in the country. So under this right to rent check scheme, basically landlords or their agents will be obliged to ask all prospective tenants for proof that they are British citizens from the EEA, which is the European Economic Area, or Swiss nationals. So that means that they're allowed to live here, no problem, no questions asked, or that they've been granted right to leave to remain in the UK, so that they're allowed to live here and they come from another country. And if they can't supply that, then they shouldn't rent them the property and they could be fined up to £3,000. Now, there's a question as to whether this is a good idea or not, in that the National Landlords Association has said they don't think this is too onerous, that landlords will be doing tenancy checks anyway. Mm-hmm. So all this stuff should come up. Critics have said, well, you can do this, but what it will do is it will force the people who, you know, maybe are living here illegally into the arms of people who are willing to, you know, flout the rules and provide them with inferior conditions to live in and potentially unsafe conditions to live in.
But you imagine how much they're doing that anyway.
Well,
how many people are going to be affected by this?
We've seen this whole beds in sheds thing, haven't you? Mm. Where you see these buildings at the end of people's gardens. So I don't know. It's difficult to tell, but I tell you what, it's something that people do need to be aware of if they are landlords. I'd say, you know, make this one of the things that you read up about. Read up about the regulation, get on board with it and realise what you're meant to be doing, because the last thing you want is someone coming around and fining you £3,000.
Another thing to consider. Let's turn our attention then to switching bank accounts and the Financial Conduct Authority saying that despite the 7-day switching service for changing current accounts, the number of us switching remains pretty low. They also found that more of us would be willing to switch if we could keep the same account number. Now, Mark, you've been looking at switching deals available, but first, what do you think of the FCA's comments about not enough switching? Apparently, consumers are unaware, we lack confidence. If we could keep our account number, then that would be better.
Well, I think what the FCA is reflecting is what a lot of us already know, is that people are ultimately pretty lazy. And switching an account is a lot of hassle. If you've got to get a new account number, and the new provider should ultimately set up all your direct debits, but then there's always a risk that they don't. And then you need to kind of make sure you're getting in touch with your energy provider and everyone else you're paying money to make sure they've got your new details. You may need to inform your employer so you can still get paid. And if you look at something like energy switching, that's all sort of done for you. It just happens straight away and you just get your new details. But yeah, with a bank, you need to then worry about your new account number, possibly a new debit card to think about. There's just a whole new load of paperwork to consider.
I wonder, I mean, you mentioned lazy there, whether there's also a bit of a fear, because this is our money we're talking about. So if something goes wrong, bad consequences happen. Also, is it worth it? And I'm going to talk about Clydesdale and Yorkshire Banks. Now, they've relaunched their 150 bonus for switching current accounts. There's quite a few banks, 5 banks, in fact, now offer cash incentives of up to £150 to get us to move our accounts over. But when you look into perhaps the finer details, getting the bonus, so you have to switch. This is specifically for for these Clydesdale and Yorkshire banks I'm talking about, switch a minimum of 2 active direct debits, pay in at least £1,000 within the first 31 days of completing the full transfer. And then to get your £150, you might have to wait up to 70 days. And there are other considerations. You've got to wonder, goodness me, is it worth it? Are banks so different from each other that it is really worth it?
I think it is, to be perfectly honest. I think it's interesting, this thing about keeping your bank account number. And yes, people remember their bank details and their bank account number, but most of the time you've got the card in your pocket. It's interesting how people are more attached to their bank account number and sort code than they are to the idea of someone paying them £125
worth of free money. Do you know your bank account and sort code number?
No, I don't, but I used to, and then I switched banks and now I don't know it. And I don't find that it's caused any major deterioration to my life.
Yeah, it's not like a mobile phone number, is
no,
it?
No, no. You know what? There's loads of people out there who don't know their own mobile phone numbers, I reckon. But the thing to think about is not just the free money. Don't just get tempted by the free money. Think about whether the account is going to suit you. Is there something that the account does that will benefit you? So, for example, Halifax will pay you to switch to its current account, but it also gives people £5 a month if they're in credit on their balances. But on the flip side, if you're the kind of person who goes overdrawn all the time, that's probably not a good account for you. First Direct will pay you to join them, and they also come out top for customer service across the board, pretty much. So actually, if you value really good customer service, then go to First Direct, and you might find that moving your bank does actually genuinely, you know, improve your banking. With the Clydesdale and Yorkshire thing, you highlighted all of the hoops that you've got to jump through there. And there is an element of putting in place some of these restrictions to stop people just cruising around the bank accounts, taking £100 here and £125 there and £150 there. And also, there is an element of, you know, say, for example, these accounts where you have to pay in a minimum every month. It's kind of to stop people, A, using an interest-paying current account just as a savings account, so it's to try and keep them using it as a current account, and B, it filters out the people who don't have so much money and who the bank won't make so much money off. So they are going after the wealthier end of the scale, who they can try and sell more products to, and it's more worthwhile selling them. And the one thing I would say about Clydesdale and Yorkshire is that in the past, we have had numerous questions raised over their customer service. I don't know whether they are greatly improved now, but there have been problems in the past. So, you know, they might be offering you £150, but think about that as well, you know. Evaluate whether you still think that those issues are there. And it's about not just taking the money, not just going for the high interest rate. It's about how's that bank account going to suit you. And the reality is that most people's existing bank accounts don't do anything for them, so you might as well get one that does.
Also, if cash doesn't float your boat, as it were, there are other options. For example, Nationwide paying 5% on balances up to £2,500 for the first 12 months with their Flex Direct account. Santander, if you've got a bigger balance, offering to pay 3% on balances up to £20,000 with its 123 current account. So how do you go about switching if you do want to switch?
Find the bank that you want to move to, go to it, fill in their forms, and they'll do all the work for you.
Nice and simple.
And if it goes wrong, they should sort you out.
How do you find it?
How do you find that bank account?
The best deals.
Well, you go to This Is Money, of course, don't you? And you read our roundup of the best bank accounts.
I teed you up so nicely.
We've got a whole team that includes Mark working on this stuff all the time.
Day and night.
I can totally imagine it. And you say that protection is all in place should a switch go wrong?
Yeah. Under the switching rules, basically they should switch you within a certain period, the 7-day switching thing, and if stuff goes wrong and the payments go missing, they should sort you out. And you know what, if you do switch and it does go wrong and the bank doesn't help you and it's clearly the bank's fault, email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk or tweet us at thisismoney and we will try and sort it out for you.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
Now, away from switching and thinking about pensions, retirements, and perhaps you're in your 20s, your 30s, your 40s. And, you know, you're thinking about buying a property. Perhaps you want to get married, have children, pay bills. So many considerations now that really saving for retirement can feel such a long way down your list of your priorities. But saving early is the best way to give yourself a richer and happier retirement, according to Simon Lambert, who's been looking into this. And Simon, what's interesting about you looking into this is this was all from email exchange with a reader, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. In fact, a reader emailed us because he's basically close to retirement and he had a pension pot, a number of different pensions all together, and he was wondering what to do with them and how to invest them. And I think this is going to be a big question with the new sort of pension freedom rules, which means people have this flexibility to keep their pension invested, is where do I invest it? But the other thing he said about was this sort of slight regret that he hadn't saved more into that pension over the time. And I think it's, to me, it basically summed up exactly why you should start saving early. And this is what he said. One of the things not felt by those of a normal working age is that when you are working, retirement is an age away. It happens to other people. You've got all the time in the world to get things right. When you're on the threshold or walking down the corridor of retirement, there's no time to make investments which require some time to come good. Everything has to work positively from day one. So he's talking about nearing retirement, but it really actually that talks directly to younger people. It's the reason why you need to do this now and find the money to start doing it now is because one day you'll turn around and you'll be nearing retirement and you'll wonder where all that time went. Like, wow, where did that 20, 30 years go? And it'll be too late by then to try and get yourself that richer retirement. And the earlier you start doing it, the easier it is. So I ran some numbers for us today, basically. So if you say put aside £100 every month, so this roughly would equate to if you were on a salary of £25,000 and you put aside 5% of your earnings, that would be about £100 a month. If you did that every month for 20 years and you got a 5% return on that money over time, you'd have £41,000. If you did it for 30 years, so you just started doing it 10 years earlier, you'd have £83,225. Right. That's more than twice as much. And that's due to what often gets referred to, a bit of a cliche, Einstein's, you know, eighth wonder of the world, the magic of compound interest. So that money that you're putting in and the return you're getting on it is compounding over time. And if you did it for 40 years, so say, for example, from the age of 25 through to 65, a 40-year career, put in £100 a month, you'd have £152,600. So it shows that between that, you know, that extra time that's spent saving makes a real difference. And I genuinely understand the issue here is people say, well, look, I've got my student loan payments. I've got my rent. I've got my energy bills. I've got my petrol costs or my travel costs. I've got the money that I'm trying to save for a deposit for a house. Where am I going to find this money? I don't have this money and I need to be paid more. But the problem is that all of that essential stuff, you have to treat saving for your pension also as part of that essential stuff, because otherwise, down the line, it's going to cause yourself a problem. And we've got auto-enrolment now where people are put automatically into pensions, but it's not enough, basically. They're not putting enough in. And even if you can only put a small amount in, doing it 10 years early makes a big difference.
Now, you don't just talk about savings and pensions. You also, in this article, mention other ways in which you can save, for example, an ISA.
Yeah, you can do it into an ISA as well. You can invest into an ISA. Just invest into a broad tracker fund in an investing ISA, into, say, a global tracker fund, which is a fund that it's not got a fund manager trying to beat the market. It just invests around the world. And over time, the returns from that should build up. And you can use ones that will also put you into not just shares, but also bonds, and give you sort of this balance of assets. But the advantage of a pension is also one of its great disadvantages. So pensions are inflexible. You can't get that money till you're 55. And that age is meant to be rising. But also that's one of its great benefits. You can't get that money till you're 55. Mm-hmm. Once you put it in there, you can't just take it out and spend it. Whereas with an ISA, you can access that money. And I must admit, to my mind, the money I'm putting into my pension every month is for my retirement, and I don't want to be able to get at it. Obviously, you have a problem that politicians can try and get at it too, but, you know.
55 seems quite young, I always think, as well.
Lots of people have this dream of early retirement, don't they? And there are people who have to retire because of health reasons or ill health, but I think maybe that thought and dream of early retirement is changing now, and maybe people are thinking of working a bit longer. But there's always the opportunity of taking your pension and then doing some work as well to supplement it. You don't have to work full time, but people, if you're thinking of taking your pension early, what you need to think about is like the gap until you get your state pension, and it's can you fill that gap with your pension savings, or do you risk running them down? And when you talk to a lot of experts, that's the thing that they really pinpoint for people to think about.
What I like in your article is, and you mentioned it a little bit there, the advantage going back of an ISA has for it is at the moment no one is constantly meddling with the system in a way that they do with pensions, which then leads us on rather nicely to speculations about the budget and more changes to pensions potentially.
Well, yeah, there's a suggestion that they might develop a system where people can sell their annuities, which are the products they've bought to provide them with an income for the rest of their life. Now, most people won't have to buy those, but in the past they did, and they feel they've got a raw deal. Should they be able to sell those on? I don't know how they're going to create a market in secondhand annuities. I'll be interested to see. The other suggestion is they might cut back on the lifetime allowance, the amount you can save into a pension before you get heavily taxed, which is something we were talking about on the last show. But there is this feeling that there is, you know, constant meddling. Some of it's been for the good. The pension freedom stuff's been for the good. But you do need a firm framework in place that people can save into.
So talking about the budget on Wednesday, the 18th of March, Simon, Mark, I want to know from you, what do you want George Osborne to do for you?
Can I make two wishes?
You can make three. Four.
Can I do a purely selfless one? I think they could go further on with stamp duty changes and make kind of regional charges to reflect property prices in London and other regions. And on a purely selfish point of view, I think they could do more on childcare, because obviously they're reforming the childcare voucher system where it's going to come off away from employers and there'll be a more central system. But I think they need to do more in terms of after-school clubs and free childcare for kids who are older than three or four.
Simon, you?
Well, do you know what? I find myself in 100% agreement with Mark there. I think that what he did in the autumn statement to reform stamp duty was really good. It had been a long time coming, but I still think people pay too much stamp duty. It's just the overall amount is too high. And I think that there is an issue surrounding inheritance tax as well, where, you know, people are paying too much inheritance tax. It's trapping people in the system who weren't meant to be trapped in it. But on the childcare thing, I agree. I basically think I would like to see a big expansion of the amount of childcare and also that you could pay for out of pre-tax income, because the amount that you can get now, I mean, my two daughters go to nursery one day a week, and me and my wife combined cannot cover one day a week's worth of nursery for the two of them with that current allowance for childcare. I'd like to see it much higher. And maybe also for people without children, they should bring in something like, if you're paying, you know, $3,500 to get to work on a train, maybe you should be able to get that out of your pre-tax income.
Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Mark Shoffman, the This Is Money team, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Thank you so much for joining us.
On digital radio and online, this is Share Radio.